Good afternoon. We will hear Consumer Watchdog versus Wisconsin Alumni Research. Ms. Hassan?
May it please the Court. The statute under which Consumer Watchdog seeks judicial review applies only to a concretely defined class of injured persons. Every person within the class shares a set of facts, a set of injuries, in fact, that differentiate them from other third parties.
Is this more than a procedural right? I mean, what the statute says is you have the right to request a re-exam, right? Isn't that a procedural right, the nature of which is similar to the other cases which have not gone your way under the APA and the ESA?
Section 311 gives us the right to request a re-examination. Section 311 applies to any third party requester at any time. Section 315 gives third party requesters who have received a final decision the right to appeal that decision. And it is under Section 315 that we appeal. Every person to whom Section 315 applies has suffered certain injuries in fact. First, they are also subject to Section 317, the estoppel provision, which prevents them from challenging the patent in the future, either at the PTO or in litigation. In order to receive a final decision, they also had to pass the burden of Section 313. Section 313 says that the examiner will order a re-exam when the requester has presented a substantial new question of patentability. So
you threw out rather quickly that they suffer an injury. What's the injury they suffer?
Well, they give up their right to challenge the patent in the future through re-exam or litigation. I'm going through the injuries. That's one.
Is that a procedural matter? Is that what's the implications of that?
Well, a difference.
Of course, we're looking for a constitutional injury in fact. So, how does that fit within the constitutional dimension of injury?
Well, there are a few injuries. That is one, because they give up a right that others have. They are differentiated from others, and they've given up the right to challenge the patent.
But where is that concrete? Where is that? I mean, when they're not a party, they're not practicing anything. I mean, that may be speculative, I guess, in theory it may be true, but how is that injury at all concrete? Anything more than complete speculation?
Well, it applies to them and not to others, and it specifically applies to them. So they've given up a right. I'll go through the other injuries as well. They are that in order to have the examiner initiate the re-exam, they had to meet their threshold burden of proof. They had to put in time and effort to present a substantial question of patentability. And third, in Section 311, they had to, in order to get the examiner to initiate the re-exam, they had to comply with the requirements of the request under 311B. Now, 311A says that any third-party requester at any time may request a re-exam, but it's 311B that really is the limiting factor on who requests a re-exam, because 311B says that the requester must not only, A, pay a fee, which must accompany any re-exam request, so there's an economic injury to any requester, and second, the requester must set forth the pertinency and manner of applying cited prior art to the claims for which re-examination is sought. So,
but the patent poses no risk at all to consumer watchdogs, so how is this a constitutional injury that we are seeking?
The injury, the legal injury, is the violation of the third-party requester's right, of consumer watchdog's right, to a satisfactory decision.
But that's a procedural right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes, but didn't it in Lujan, I mean, I direct your attention to note 8 of Lujan on page 573. It says that even when you're talking about procedural rights, the procedural right still has to endanger a concrete interest of the plaintiff apart from his having interest in the procedures observed. I understand you think that your procedural rights have been impaired because you got inter-parties review and you didn't get a decision that you're satisfied with, but what's the separate concrete interest endangered?
The Lujan talks about cases in which Congress can elevate to legally cognizable concrete de facto injuries that were previously inadequate at law. And that is exactly what Congress did here in Lujan.
They can create a right, that's true, the deprivation of which is an injury. But has there been a right created here, the deprivation of which is a constitutional injury?
Yes, absolutely.
What's that?
We have, our interest is in a decision with which we are satisfied, and the way that we have secured...
Yeah, but that's true of everybody in the room and everybody beyond this room. You haven't suffered a injury of constitutional dimension when it's something that affects everyone uniformly. We all have an interest in good government. We all have an interest in valid property rights. But what's your specific constitutional dimension injury?
The reason not everyone has an interest in the satisfactory decision in this reexamination, only Consumer Watchdog has an interest, has a concrete interest in a satisfactory decision in this reexamination, because only Consumer Watchdog paid the fee, found the prior art.
But that's true in a lot of other administrative cases where people have rights to appear at an administrative level and they don't have rights to appear in a circuit court. I mean, there's decisions from the D.C. Circuit saying that. There's decisions from the Seventh Circuit saying that, and probably from a lot of other circuits. The fact that you were allowed to participate, you paid a fee, you expended resources, that's not an injury under the Constitution. You have to show something directly tying your interest specifically in this litigation to an injury in fact and not just a procedural injury.
And the injury in fact is what gives us the right, what secures our interest in the satisfactory decision. The injuries in fact are
this way. Yeah, the statute doesn't give you a right to obtain a decision that you desire. You don't get a right to have a decision in your favor. And that's really the only injury that you're giving to us, is that we didn't win and that somehow deprives us of something. As you understand, that's not a, I like the term constitutional injury. Don't you have to show us commercial harm or jeopardy to your business or your standing in the marketplace or something of that nature?
The FOIA cases are a perfect analogy, because in FOIA, all that is required of the requester is that they made the request and they were denied.
No. You have a right in FOIA to receive that information unless it fits within an exception.
And
but you're given a right. Upon request, you have a right to receive that. Now, see, you don't have upon request here a right to deny this patent.
Once a requester has gotten the examiner to initiate the reexamination, they do have a right to a decision on an invalid patent, the same way that a FOIA requester has a right to information.
Not the decision you desire. You just get a right to a decision. You got that. But where's your injury that allows you then to go to an Article III court?
We cast doubt on the validity of the patent, and Section 315 gives us the right to cancellation of claims that are invalid, the same way that FOIA requesters have a right to information that doesn't fall within the exemptions. It's a perfect analogy.
Is it really? Wouldn't the analogy be that you have a right to receive a patent? That right was denied by the unfavorable outcome, and because you didn't get the patent, then you say, now I have a injury in fact, because the Congress created a right, the deprivation of which causes me an injury. But they didn't create that kind of right for you, did
Congress
they?
Created a right for parties
a right to be heard. Yeah, that's the procedural thing. But not a right to receive anything, the deprivation of which causes you a constitutional injury.
Well, similarly, you could say that in FOIA, the requesters are not entitled to information because the information may or may not fall within the exemption.
They are entitled to information. Isn't that the distinct difference here?
They are entitled to information that doesn't fall within one of the nine exemptions.
They get to be heard. To information. It's a non-discretionary right, and they're the ones that get to decide what information they seek, and the government can only withhold it unless they show that it meets one of the exceptions. The analogy, I think, in your case would not be that, as you're saying, that you have the right to seek cancellation. The analogy would be if you had an absolute right to cancel the patent.
We do have the right to cancel a patent that is invalid, the way that the FOIA has the right.
The statute doesn't say anything remotely like that.
I want to make sure to reserve some rebuttal time.
You've got it. Yeah, don't worry. You've got it. Okay. Why don't you finish his question? We'll make sure you get your rebuttal.
I mean, if the statute says a third-party requester can cancel a patent, you might have a different case, but that's completely at odds with the system. What you're saying is a third-party requester can put forth grounds on which it thinks strongly that the patent should be canceled, but there are two different things there.
I think we're confusing 311 with 315. 311 gives any
I don't think it really matters. I think you have to show you have an absolute right to cancel a patent.
We have an absolute right to cancel an invalid patent.
Thank you, Ms. Hassan, very much. We'll make sure you get a full rebuttal time. Am I speaking first to Ms. Stoll or to Mr. Freeman? Mr. Freeman, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Judge. May it please the Court, Mark Freeman for the United States, including the United States Patent and Trademark Office. I'm happy to begin anywhere that may be of assistance to the Court. We do think that, for the reasons the Court has already expressed, there is not a direct analogy.
Congress, though, seems to have expected that anybody who appeals is going to get a right to come here, didn't they? They say anybody.
Right. And they said any person in the Endangered Species Act provision that was at issue in Lujan. We think the answer is, yeah, when Congress enacts a right for any person to go to an Article III court, implicit in that is a person who meets the requirements of Article III.
But this is a little different than the ESA and the endangered species, because here you've got a balance that Congress has created. This whole system is a balance. If the patentee loses,
right,
they have a right to go and get judicial review. Congress is trying to create a balance, and here,
right,
under the system you're proposing, many, if not most, of people who lose on the other side, the non-patentee, will not have that right.
So let me address that. There are a couple of points there. First, I want to put down a marker. We can come back to this, but I don't think it's true that many, if not most, claimants will not have standing
some
to appeal. Some. But let's just note that, for example, the PTO statistics, a little hard for them to track, but it's something like 50 to 75% of inter partes reexaminations involve parties already in litigation. Those parties would obviously have standing. And in addition, as we suggest in our brief, competitors, others would have standing. This is the easy case because this is a party who has no interest at all in the underlying patent. But let me go back to your point. Congress obviously intended to allow third-party requesters to give useful information to the Patent Office, to have them make quality decisions. That is an extremely valuable public interest, irrespective of whether an individual claimant has standing to appeal. This case illustrates that because in this case, the request forced Wharf to amend its claims. That was that's a benefit to the public, irrespective of appealability. And then as to the sort of equal fairness point, about if the patent owner can appeal, why wouldn't it be the case that the requester can appeal? I would refer the court to a case that's cited in the briefs. It's a bit of a complex case, but I think it has a family resemblance to the situation here. It's the Asarco versus Kadish case in the Supreme Court. That case, I say it has family resemblance because what it involved was a state court decision. It was a non-Article III tribunal, in that case a state court, here an agency, allowed litigation on terms that did not involve Article III. State courts are, of course, not required to comply with Article III. And the question the Supreme Court grappled with in that case was there was a plaintiff who would not have had standing to bring suit in federal court, no standing at all, but in state court was allowed to bring a federal law claim against a defendant. The defendant lost in the state Supreme Court and tried to go to the Supreme Court. And the question, the case was, well, this litigation could never have been in federal court in the first instance. The plaintiff couldn't have brought it, but the defendant didn't choose to be there, and he lost as a result of on a federal law question. And what the Supreme Court said was, we do have Article III jurisdiction because the action of the of the non-Article III tribunal itself inflicted an injury on the defendant. So the analogy in this case would be if Worf's patent had been declared invalid. Worf could appeal to this court because the patent office's decision, which is independently operative, regardless of the underlying, whether, you know...
Well, certainly. I mean, I don't think anybody's disputing that, but they have the right to judicial review.
But the reason I mention this is because it was also clear in ASARCO that no one thought that if the plaintiff in the state court decision had won in the state court, that the plaintiff could have gone to the Supreme Court, because the plaintiff did not meet the requirements of Article III standing.
Is there a way that Congress could fix this?
Well, yes, you can give the...
crafting the provisions in a way that would create some sort of standing.
We know that Congress can write it depends on what you mean, Your Honor. Congress cannot, the Supreme Court said in the Summers case, the Article III injury is the hard, injury in fact is the hard floor of Article III that cannot be removed by statute. It's directly from the Summers decision. So Congress can't write a statute that says there is here in this statute no requirement of Article III injury. But Congress can frame the scheme so that any person who triggers it is has something personal at stake. I mean, I think the Chief Judge made an interesting example before. I suppose you probably have standing if the way this worked is that if a plaintiff who sought reexamination and obtained a change in the claims, then won ownership of the patent. Well, you know, sort of bounty system. That you might very
no,
well.
No, no, no. I'm talking about somebody like Consumer Watchdog in these circumstances. Is it a matter of Congress coming up with purposes or an intent that suggests that they think patents are so valuable and have such an impact on the economy and on individuals and the cost of goods and yada-da, and so they making their own argument through a purposes section or whatever that would suggest injury?
Your Honor, I think it would be very difficult. Now, it shouldn't be surprising if we understand that to mean that Congress can't write a statute that allows a person who has no interest whatsoever in someone else's property to challenge the legal validity
but
of that property.
But Lujan recognizes that in certain circumstances they can do that because they create a cause of action.
Yeah.
Causation. The FOIA case, I think, is a perfect example of
yes.
that. And don't let my harsh or somewhat difficult questions to your colleague FOIA. I think the FOIA example is a very good one.
Oh, no, it is. I agree with that.
You would agree that before FOIA, an individual off the street couldn't come to the government
yes.
and say, I want this information,
that's
and
true.
Then sue in court. There would be no standing.
That's true.
So they gave a right, and then they created a cause of action, and nobody disputes standing anymore.
That's true.
How would they do that
yes.
here for groups like consumer?
I think you would have to come up with a concrete, substantive, personal right that to which any applicant would be entitled. It's very difficult
well,
for me
that's
to.
That's what I want to ask you. Why isn't that what they've done? The statutes read very, very similarly to me. In FOIA, you have a right to seek information. If you don't get it, you have a right to sue. Here, you have a right to challenge a patent. If your challenge is unsuccessful, you have a right to sue.
So the right to challenge the patent. So in the FOIA cases, Your Honor, if you ask for, let me put it this way: if my friend on the other side of the courtroom here were to file a FOIA request and didn't get what she asked for, I don't have standing to ask that to sue and say that the government has to give the documents to her. The reason why that illustrates the personal nature of the FOIA claim. It is that the obligation under FOIA for this to give is because it is a personal injury to the requester. If you take, for example,
but she doesn't have an automatic right to every document she requests.
No,
there's
no.
an analysis, there are exceptions
yes.
to the rule, and so forth.
No, of course, and that's true in any legal claim. You don't have an automatic right to win, but you do have a right to assert it. You have a right to ask an Article III court to resolve your case or controversy. But the case or controversy must be extant. And in the dialogue, we referred to things like the fee that they have to file and other things. The Supreme Court has directly addressed that. In the Diamond versus Charles case, it said the attorney's fees are not good enough to give Article III standing. In the Stevens case, Vermont Agency versus Stevens, the Supreme Court said that injuries pertinent to or byproducts of the litigation itself are not Article III injuries. So those are that's the reason why those
now,
things.
Now, in your brief, you suggest that if we were to desire to engage in line drawing, there ought to be a distinction drawn between DJs
and these cases in terms of injuries. So I own an iPhone, and I'm worried that I might be infringing a Samsung patent. Can I go into the patent office and get judicial review if I lose?
You may very well be able to if you make the showing about standing. And we point out in footnote 2 of our brief the way that the D.C. Circuit, which encounters this problem with some frequency, deals with these questions. If you go into we all agree you would have the right to file a request.
Now, I couldn't file a D.J.
No, you could not file a declaratory judgment action. But you could file a request for inter partes review, produce your prior art, that you go through the process, you lose or win in the patent office. Of course, if you won, Samsung undoubtedly could appeal. If you lose, you would have to show when you came to this court through an affidavit or a declaration that you have some reason to believe that you might be infringing the patent, and that if you are infringing the patent and you have some reason to believe that may actually affect your real life, then you would have standing. And that may not be the same as and in fact, I think it would not be the same analysis that would follow in a declaratory judgment case. The fact that Congress has given you...
So what gives us the basis for drawing that distinction? Well, language by Justice Kennedy in the opinion?
No, we walk through a couple of the things in our brief. So the fact that Congress has given to a particular person a direct and specific right to appeal to an Article III court does not eliminate the injury in fact requirement, but it does eliminate other things. For example, it eliminates all prudential aspects of the Article III inquiry. And prudential ripeness, prudential standing, as the court is well aware, there are ample cases discussing prudential aspects of Article III. All that falls away when Congress says, no, this person gets to appeal within 30 days. Secondly, the Supreme Court, this is footnote 7 of the Lujan decision, it's also in the majority, text of the majority opinion in the Massachusetts versus EPA case, has explained that when you have a procedural right, such as the right to go to an Article III court, that may relax the redressability and immediacy requirements of Article III. So, for example, in Your Honor's hypothetical, if you filed a declaratory judgment action, you might well lose on ripeness grounds because we have no idea whether Samsung has any intention of coming after you. Well, if you have some possibility, just future, real, but future possibility of that happening, then the immediacy requirements of Article III may be relaxed by the fact that Congress has said, no, we want this person, if they have an injury in fact, to be able to come to court. And the last point we make in our brief is the estoppel provisions.
So if instead of a consumer watchdog, which is just a taxpayer watchdog group,
yes,
without members, you had an association of science professors or science research that work in the stem cell area,
yes,
and they had filed this.
Mm-hmm.
Would they have standing?
If they made the showing with the declarations on the time they came into this court, they said, look, some substantial number of our members work in the area of human embryonic stem cells. We've never been threatened with infringement of the 913 patent, but we worry that we might want to do this type of this research now or in the future, and we are concerned that the patent is invalid. The patent office's requirement that Wharf amend its claims was not sufficient to redress that injury.
What happens if, as soon as they file that, Wharf, and I'll ask your friend sitting next to you this, but Wharf just gives covenants not to sue to all of those people. How would this issue on this patent ever get to us?
Well, the covenant not to sue problem is, of course, a problem that is not limited to this context. It's all manner of challenges. And the limits of the Supreme Court's rule in the Nike case are not entirely certain. But I think that what we know is that the covenant not to sue would have to provide complete and total protection. And if it were not sufficient, and there were some reasonable basis to believe it was not complete and total protection, then it wouldn't be good enough. The other point I would add is...
So I want to follow up on that in the terms of this kind of this association or something. If their view was, we have a few professors, but we're representing everybody, and Wharf came in and just gave covenants not to sue to the named professors, there may still be a live issue there.
I think there might well be, Your Honor. It would depend... Of course, there are doctrines about representational standing and organizational standing. You would have to be in compliance with those doctrines, and the declarations that they would give to this court would have to provide evidence for that.
But I guess if they gave a covenant to sue that say we're never going to assert infringement against any researcher based upon this patent, then it really doesn't matter what the outcome of the PTO was.
Exactly,
it's not going to be asserted.
Exactly. But on the other hand, if they only said as to two or three members. and the organization said, look, we don't even, there may be others. If you couple with that, and this is the point I was getting to a little bit earlier, the estoppel provisions that are in the Act, you know, those provisions, they don't themselves create an injury, because if Consumer Watchdog will never be sued under the 913 patent, the fact that now or in the future they can't bring another one of these proceedings doesn't affect their real-life rights. But for a party that may one day face a claim, it may have the effect of essentially accelerating the controversy, because it becomes a question of now or never. And that, we think, in a close case, may well tip the balance toward justiciability. So the point, if I may just sort of circle back and make, is that it is absolutely the case that the Article III injury in fact requirement applies and appeals out of the PTO. It is absolutely the case that an organization like Consumer Watchdog, which has no concrete injury in fact, it's not just a legal injury, but an injury in fact from the validity of the 913 patent, has no standing. But it will very often be the case that the sort of entities for whom Congress enacted this scheme will have that standing, will be able to make that showing to this court. And indeed, the court's opinion in this case, I expect, will provide a great deal of guidance to those bringing those appeals about exactly what sort of evidence they need to show. But Congress, we don't think they intended to, and certainly could not, have enacted a statute that would allow an organization like Consumer Watchdog, merely by the fact of this procedural opportunity, to challenge a patent in which it has no actual interest.
All right, Mr. Friedman, thank you very much. Ms. Stoll.
Thank you. May it please the court. I want to make it clear for the court that Wharf agrees with the government on the positions that it has in its brief and that the positions it's taken today. For example, with respect to the government's brief at pages 13.
Mr. Freeman didn't quite get to the estoppel provision. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, we would agree with Mr. Freeman's position that the estoppel provision could, in some cases, make an injury more concrete and immediate. We don't think it would apply.
But I think what he was suggesting is that that too is speculative, but sufficient, but very speculative, right?
Right.
If someday they might be charged with infringement.
I think it would depend on how speculative it was. You'd have to consider a totality of circumstances like you do in all Article III standing cases. And one of those circumstances would, of course, be the patent owner's behavior and what the likelihood would be that the patent owner might assert that patent. Factors that you would consider are things like the relationship between the patent owner and the requester. Are they competitors? Have they had litigation in the past, patent litigation in the past? The requester's level of interest in the patent. Is there some commercial activity that they're prohibited from engaging in or they're, you know, concerned about engaging in because of the patent?
Now, I think it was your position initially, although maybe wrong about this, that you said the same requirements apply to DJ jurisdictions they do in these circumstances. Now that you say you agree with the government, do you agree with their more relaxed standards with regard to this?
That's true. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to start with this, was that after reviewing the government's brief and having more of an opportunity to think about that issue, we think that the government's position makes the most sense. And given the Supreme Court statements in Lujan and EPA versus Massachusetts, where they talked about how the requirements of redressability and immediacy would be lessened or might not even apply where you have a procedural right to appeal, I think the position the government takes makes a lot of sense. I also would want to point out that in preparing for this argument, we did look at statistics published on the PTO's website just with respect to the AIA's inter-parties review proceedings and post-grant review proceedings. And so far, of those inter-parties review and covered business method petitions filed, 89% of them on their face at the time of the filing indicate that there is a concurrent district court litigation between the patent owner and...
What percent was that?
89. And these are just...
About business method patents?
These are the covered business method patents and the inter-party proceedings, just those filed after the passage of the AIA.
The business method patents part is a little misleading, isn't it? Because doesn't that specific part of the statute require an infringement suit to be ongoing or something like that?
Yes, it does. So let me tell you what the statistics for IPR alone.
Instances would always have to.
That is true. For the IPRs alone, 97 out of 805 had no associated litigation identified on the face of the petition. So that translates into about 88% where there is a current district court litigation identified on the face of the, at least on the face of the filing when they first filed. That doesn't account for a situation where someone's been threatened or where after the IPR is filed, the patent owner files some litigation. With respect to some of the other factors, to throw them out there, factors we thought about that are relevant to the inquiry are the patent owner's behavior, and specifically where there's a threat of enforcement of the patent. Is the patent owner licensing the patent for free, like Worf currently does with universities, or do they have a past history of bringing lawsuits?
Well, what about, is the process of having to get a license, even if it's for free, a sufficient injury?
I don't think so, no. If it's not, I wouldn't think so. I don't think, you'd have to look at each circumstance, but I wouldn't think that it would be if it's for free. Now, if there's also for commercial entities, Worf does charge for a license. So in that circumstance, there might be standing. I would say that I was asked last time where he would draw the line, and the only bright line that I could think of here would be that an organization that claims no commercial interest in the patent is not a competitor, a prospective competitor, a licensee or a prospective licensee, and has no basis for membership or organizational standing. Lacks Article 3.
What about an iPhone user?
The iPhone user? I think that that's an interesting situation. I think you'd have to look at whether Samsung, whether there's any indication whatsoever that Samsung would assert its patents against an end user. Court have any further questions?
Thank you, Ms. Stoll. Ms. Hassan, please take the time you need. We understand that there was plenty of time on the other side. And
thank
we're very
you.
Very liberal with your time needs.
Thank you. I'd like to clarify that our dispute is between Consumer Watchdog and the government. So the controversy that we need to standing to support is between us and the government. It doesn't matter how Worf asserts its patent. It doesn't matter what interest we have in practicing Worf's patent, because the interest that Congress has given us, the interest that Congress has elevated to legally cognizable, is our interest in a satisfactory decision. And in Section 141, the same language is used for patent owners as for third-party requesters, that there's a right to appeal a decision with which that party is dissatisfied.
Sure, but if a patent owner gets denied a patent, then they have a concrete interest. There's no dispute there.
And we have a concrete interest when we are denied the decision in which we have invested time, effort, energy, met our threshold burden of proof, and given up a right. And this is the right that Congress gave us. Second, so evaluating whether we are competing with Worf to practice their patent or whether Worf has asserted its patent is evaluating standing in a dispute with Worf, when the standing that we're arguing we have is in a dispute with the government. It's like taking the temperature in Washington to figure out whether it's cold in Los Angeles. It's completely measuring the wrong thing. Second, there is no place in the FOIA statute, and neither Worf nor the government has argued that there is, where it says...
Can you talk to me a minute about the procedural substantive distinction here? All of your concerns about your dispute with the government are on kind of a procedural level, that you wish to have a right to make your arguments, but is there a as you know, the Constitution requires this concrete injury, usually economic in nature in our area. Do you have anything of that nature that you can point to?
Well, in order to receive a final decision, we had to, for example, pay a fee of $8,800. That's an economic injury that we suffered in order to become within the class of persons who has this right of appeal. In addition, we had...
Again, that's though not a stake in the decision's outcome. That's merely a gatekeeping matter that would be true of anyone who entered the front door. Again, any member of the public will have to pay the fee.
And that
You've
was
You've
got
to have this unique injury, in fact, to you and your interest that's different from the general public.
It was Congress's decision to... make it such that everyone who reached...
It seems like Congress intended to do exactly what you're saying they intended to do, but under Lujan and Massachusetts versus EPA, they can't just, you know, write something and say, you have a right to appeal. They still have to show some kind of concrete injury that they're trying to protect by these procedural rights. It can't be the money you spent on the litigation or the time you invested, or things like that, because that happened in Lujan, that happened in Massachusetts versus EPA as well.
Well, in the examples that the government gave today, the money that you cannot count as an injury was money spent to a third party. It was Congress that decided to create the statute in a way that required that the requester pay a fee. Contrast it with FOIA. In FOIA, it's very easy to make a request. It's free, and all you have to do is reasonably describe the documents you want. You don't have to argue to the government, this is why I'm entitled to the information, this is why it doesn't fall within one of the 9 exemptions.
Since my first year of law school, I wanted to ask this question. What does Marbury versus Madison have to say about this case?
In Marbury versus Madison, the court was trying to prevent a situation in which the courts were able to bully the legislature, because the courts shouldn't, it's a separation of powers issue, and the court shouldn't be able to overstep
its bounds. Congress couldn't do what? Write jurisdiction that exceeded that the Constitution required, right?
Exactly, but in this case,
Is that
Congress
relevant here?
In this case, Congress ensured that every party to whom the statute applied was injured before they got to that point. The injury is inherent by virtue of the statutory scheme that Congress created. The other point I would like to make is that when you contrast with the FOIA statute, where in FOIA statutes does it say there is a right to information? Instead, it says the government must make this information public, and anyone who asks for information and is denied has the right to appeal. It's very similar to the statute here, where it says we have the Patent Act saying patents aren't supposed to be granted unless 102 and 103 are met, and somebody can challenge it, and if they get a losing decision, they're allowed to appeal.
But, I mean, the FOIA is a little different, not only because you have an absolute right to get the information, unless it falls within the exception, but because of what Congress was looking at when it enacted the FOIA statute, which was the need to get information from the government protects the First Amendment right. It protects the right to free speech and the right to the press and things like that, because in order to write effective news stories or whatever, you have to be able to get information from the government.
And
so that's a concrete injury there. I don't know of anything that this kind of thing protects, that there's some kind of right to have a patent declared invalid.
Well, first of all, none of the FOIA cases talks about an injury. The FOIA cases all say that you need to do no more than make the request and be denied in order to have standing. None of the cases talk about an absolute right to information or having an injury, an underlying injury.
Sure, but I mean, in the public citizen case, they looked at the FOIA statute in the context of another thing, and they said, you know, we agree that they're standing in the FOIA cases because of the denial of the request or the request. So I don't think there's any dispute that the people in FOIA have standing because they had a specific right to information requested and it was denied.
Exactly. That's why we also have standing here. In public citizen, they said our decisions interpreting the Freedom of Information Act have never suggested that those requesting information under it need show more than that they sought and were denied specific agency records. And here, it's a much easier case because Congress didn't make it easy for people to request a reexamination. They made you dig up the prior art and understand how the patent worked and explain element by element for every claim for which you sought reexamination, how it applies, pay a fee. So we have much, it's an easier case to show here that we have injury than it is in the FOIA cases. Congress absolutely could fix this and change it, and if they didn't want us to have this right here, they could have said so. And using the brand new standard that is advocated by our opponents would be extremely difficult to implement.
Is it a brand new standard?
I believe it is, Your Honor.
In what way?
Well, it's not declaratory judgment, and it's not following the letter of the statute. And to answer your question...
Well, it's the standard that's suggested in Massachusetts versus EPA, though, isn't it? That in these cases where a procedural right to appeal is given, you don't need the same kind of immediacy and harm requirements that you might in the declaratory judgment action. It doesn't seem that new to me at all.
But it would be very difficult to implement, and it would be very cumbersome for the court to have to make that evaluation. I'd also like to make the point that the purpose that is served here, where Judge Hughes was saying that the purpose of FOIA is to give the public rights to information that the public should, that the government should disclose, this court has said that in Patlex v. Mossinghoff, that the reexamination statute's purpose is to correct errors made by the government to remedy defective government, not private, action, and if need be, to remove patents that never should have been granted. Reiterating our point that our dispute is with the government and not with the court. Have any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the double effort that both parties gave to this case. Thank you very much.
All rise.